This is Tall Tale TV, your podcast for sci-fi and fantasy short stories. This story has multiple parts. To listen to the entire story in one place, visit talltaletv.com/series.
Whole Lot of Shakin', a Tony Mandolin short story by Robert Beers. Chapter 4. We had a few hours before Bane was supposed to pick us up, so after getting the keys at the bell desk, we took one of the palace's elevators up to the fifth floor. The attendant told us that it was all hydraulics, that new water power system which would someday power cars across the bay and around the world, just like H.G. Wells writes about. I must say, it was one of the quietest and smoothest elevator rides I'd ever taken. After Frankie got over his gushing about how wonderful and luxurious everything was, we went back down to the ground floor, picked out a couple of outfits more typical for the period, broke one of Enrico's tens, and headed back out onto market. The weather was cool enough, we both decided to stay with coats and hats. As for our obvious other differences, those that clothing could not hide, I figured all I'd have to do was tell a questioning cop where I was staying, show him the key for proof, and that would be it. I grabbed a passing trolley car and took a ride up Market Street. It was even more remarkable being in the middle of the moving chaos that was traffic in 1906. Frankie kept pointing out cars and trucks, models and brands long since extinct in the 21st century. What I found most intriguing was the difference from what I was seeing and from what I knew as a bus passenger on this same run. Aside from the wide open feel due to the far smaller and shorter buildings, there was the green space scattered along both sides of the street. It felt for all the world like a ride in the country, right in the heart of bustling San Francisco. I was even more surprised when I saw Central Park coming into view. It looked like someone had grabbed a portion of the Marin Headlands and plopped it into the middle of the city. Fully grown oaks and madrones lined the park, and the ground between and behind the trees was filled with long grass and smaller bushes. And then I saw the smoke. One of the other passengers, obviously a tourist from somewhere in the Midwest, said, "I will bet that's from the headhunters' camp." A woman added, "Oh, dear Lord, I hope they aren't all naked and disgusting." And then the crosstalk conversation went downhill from there. I got off the trolley, thinking that things hadn't changed all that much in the past century. Most people were still idiots. The one thing that had changed was the habit of charging for everything in present-day Frisco. We just got off the car and walked into the park. That was it. No gate, no guard, nothing. It was easy to see where the tribe had been placed, as the crowd headed that way was extensive. Frankie and I just went with the flow. The city had managed to either move or recreate the village setting the Filipino tribe had back on the islands, huts roofed with rushes, the tripod-supported cookpot, and so on. I wasn't sure the pointed log wall was authentic, and I was damned sure the crowd of tourists surrounding them, gawking and pointing, wasn't.
"Interesting, isn't it?"
I turned and looked down at a woman. She had reddish-brown hair under a brimmed hat and was dressed in what can be called a conservative business style of the day. What was different is that she spoke with a British accent, and she was holding a notebook, her pencil poised over the page.
"Excuse me?"
I replied. She put the pencil away and held out her hand.
"E.M. Swifthook, reporter for the Chronicle. I wrote the article for today's paper, and I'm doing a series of follow-ups. What do you think of the display?"
From what I remembered, the notion of a woman reporter was about as rare as hen's teeth in this time. Of course, she was British. I said,
"I'm wondering more of what the display thinks of being put on display,"
I said, glancing back at the crowd. I was finding the whole thing a little disturbing. Swifthook was a real reporter, all right. She jumped on my admission like a cat on a mouse.
"Really?"
The pencil scribbled like mad.
"What makes you say that?"
Frankie entered the conversation with,
"Tony, you should have seen those villagers. They look like hobbits from the Shire."
As my brain went,
"Oh, God,"
Swifthook found a whole new goldmine of reporting in the big guy. It didn't matter if she was a real reporter or not. If what he was bound to tell her got into circulation, I looked around, desperate to find something to distract. The last thing I needed was Frankie getting into a storytelling jag and revealing where and when we were really from. To a reporter, of all things. As I said, oh my God. And then my eye caught just the sight.
Hey, Frankie,
I said, interrupting a distressingly familiar story in the work.
Isn't that Teddy Roosevelt?
Who? Where?
Frankie didn't need to do anything to see over the crowd. He just turned in the direction of my point.
Oh, wow,
he said.
Can we go meet him, Tony? He's one of my favorites, right behind Kennedy.
That did it. The reporter obviously knew the difference between a fable and a disastrous slip of the tongue. Female or not, she had the instincts. She moved so she was facing both of us, and that pencil looking more and more like a weapon.
Who are you really, and where are you really from?
Frankie looked stricken. I said,
Ma'am, you would not believe me even if I told you under whatever truth serum exists today.
Swifthook looked confused. Truth serum? What's that? Frankie murmured.
Oops.
I took her by the arm.
Tell you what, Miss Swifthook. We should talk, but not here.
What? What are you doing? Let me go!
People looked around and a few men started our way. I held out my ID. From a distance, it looks more official than it is, and said,
Police! Plain clothes! She's a pickpocket!
The look the reporter gave me should have fried me on the spot, but the crowd melted away. I even got a few claps of applause. Frankie murmured,
Smooth, Tony. Real smooth.
We rode another trolley all the way back down Market with a very sullen Swifthook in tow. I had Frankie get off first, and I handed the reporter to him and then jumped down. She glared death at me and muttered,
I suppose if I scream, you'll just flash that badge again, right?
I smiled and said,
Probably, but if you cooperate, you may just have the story of your career. How would you like to interview Mark Twain?
She didn't glare, but she didn't smile either. She looked suspicious.
What's that mean?
She asked. I looked around.
This is way too public. Let's go into the bar.
I still had hold of her arm, so I heard the muttered,
A bar is less public than this?
As we walked into the Palm Court, I saw the waiter Bane had called Andrew and called him over. He said,
Yes, Mr. Mandolin,
as he came closer. The reporter was glancing back and forth between us. I handed him a dollar bill from the 10 I had broke earlier and said,
We need a quiet table with no eavesdroppers. Can you arrange that?
He grinned big.
Yes, sir,
Swifthook said as we were led to the same corner of the lounge Ben used earlier.
Who are you?
I can't tell you,
I said.
One, you think I'm crazy, and two, it might have a potentially damaging, even fatal effect on my family.
Can't I be the judge of that? She replied with a toss of her head. I mean, it's not like you're going to say something like you're travelers from the future or outer space.
Frankie mugged a face.
Oh, no, we'd never say that. It's just that, you know.
I managed not to groan.
So what is it?
Swifthook asked, her pencil poised. I held up a hand and said,
I need a drink. Would you like a drink?
She nodded, and I signaled for Andrew. After the drinks were served and sampled, I said,
Mr. Jackson and I are detectives, and we are on a case that could have extreme consequences, especially for those on its edges. The person or persons we are after has shown no qualms about collateral damage. If you start reporting on this, you may very well include yourself and your paper in that category.
Oh, come on, she said, almost snorting. Do you really expect me to swallow a line like that? Even with my father being a board member, I may be relegated to writing fluff pieces just because I have a bosom, but that doesn't mean I'm stupid. What's really going on? And do you really know Mark Twain?
Clemens.
She looked at Frankie.
What?
His name is Clemens. Sam Clemens. Mark Twain is just a nom de plume.
She put her hand to her forehead.
Oh, my dear Lord.
We were still in the bar when Bane came for us. He said,
I didn't bother checking the rooms. I figured neither of you would be able to sit and wait quietly. By the way, you look a lot better. Who is this charming young lady?
She rose and held out her hand, just as she did when we met at the park.
E.M. Swifthook.
Ah, the Chronicle's intrepid woman reporter. Bane said, bowing over her hand. Landau Bane, at your service. How is your father?
The effect of Bane's name on Swifthook was not what I had expected, especially not after she shot down my attempt at a half-truth. Landau Bane? The adventurer? Oh my goodness! Mr. Bane, would it be too much trouble to bother you for an interview? These gentlemen say they were friends with Mark Twain, but you, Landau Bane, wow!
I guess her father went out the window. Bane then looked at us. Shall we invite this lady to the poker game? I looked at Swifthook. I thought she was going to ask him to marry her right there and then. Getting into the game was easier than I thought it would be. At the sight of Bane, the guards, yes, there were more than one, about five more, opened the door and let us stroll right in. EM, as she had insisted on being called, oohing and aahing the entire way. It wouldn't have been so bad, but Frankie was right there with her. The first door led to a room with an open bar and another door, with just two guards. But both of these fellows were close to Frankie size. I wondered, did Sam Clemens rate this level of protection? When we went into the game room, I got my answer. Teddy Roosevelt. The President of the United States at this time, and for another 3 years, was at the table. He didn't stand, he didn't need to. According to protocol, when the chief executive enters a room, everyone stands, regardless of political association. What he did do was boom out.
Bane, bully! There you are, man! I've been waiting for you! I've got a whole new game! Let's see what your tricks can do for you now, son!
Bane said, Mr. President, may I introduce two new players, Anthony Mandolin and Franklin Jackson.
Named after old Stonewall himself, eh? Roosevelt boomed. From the more southern part of the family, eh? Ha!
I wondered if the guy could talk at anything less than full volume. He turned on me.
Mr. Mandolin, a musical name. How's your game, son?
Before I could answer, Roosevelt then asked,
And who is this vision of loveliness?
I knew he wasn't talking about Frankie. Bane shifted smoothly into,
This is E.M. Swifthook, the intrepid female reporter from the Chronicle. You may know her father, Mr. President. I would go so far as to say she would be a superb addition to the White House press corps.
And give those idiots at the post a collective stroke to boot, hey, Bane?
Roosevelt laughed.
Imagine that, a woman on the press corps.
He looked at Swifthook.
Do you play, young lady?
She gulped and then said in a very small voice, I jumped in.
She sure does, Mr. President. I'm lucky to have a dollar to my name after the last game.
Bully!
Roosevelt boomed.
Bully! Martins, deal her in!
He looked at us and said,
Gentlemen, it's a dollar ante. I hope you can afford to lose.
Then he barked out a roar of laughter. As we sat, Bane took over the role of host.
You all know our esteemed Commander-in-Chief.
Roosevelt bowed his head as he fingered his chips.
Next to him is Ducky Smith, one of the few women in the new Secret Service. And next to her is Mr. Eric Craig, the only scientist to beat Russia's Tesla in chess. Watch out for him, he cheats.
Craig objected.
I do not.
But his smile said otherwise.
No, Bane said evenly. Just not badly enough to get caught.
Roosevelt boomed out another laugh.
Next to Craig is Lord Brent Harris, over here to check on his shipping concerns. No matter how much he loses, he never seems to mind.
Harris said in a Hugh Grant accent,
At 15 of your dollars to the pound, dear boy, it's cheap at twice the price.
Quite, Bane murmured, and then said,
And then we have the lovely Miss Erin Michael Hall. Mr. Jackson, you two should get to know each other. But bear in mind, she's been widowed 7 times.
Frankie muttered,
Tony!
EM's chuckle didn't help the big guy at all. Miss Michael Hall was what the papers called an ebon beauty, and the feral glance she gave Frankie was absolutely predatory. I wondered how she made it to this table, even in San Francisco.
Next, Bane went on, we have Professor Alan Van Meter, another scientist and the only man I know who was capable of making Mr. Edison so angry he actually sputtered. I like that in a man. Professor Van Meter inclined his head along with a smile to Bane. And then we have one Mr. Julian Green, a man with no known pastime, but who somehow manages to always be there after the smoke clears, and without a scratch on him. Green smirked.
Yeah, don't you love it? Come on, Bane, deal the damn cards.
Green's accent said Australia. I thought, opals? Bane shook his head. Not quite yet, Julian. I have not taken over for Mr. Martins, and I have to introduce our guests first.
But you already did. To Teddy. We all heard it.
And what does Mason say? Bane murmured. Green muttered.
Damn protocols. I want to play poker.
Roosevelt waved a hand.
Go ahead, Landau. Introduce your guests to the whole gang.
Bane inclined his head. Thank you, Mr. President. Ladies and gentlemen, standing to my left is none other than Mr. Anthony Mandolin, the man who, single-handedly, mind you, stopped that thief of Caruso's diamond necklace this morning. Murmurs went around the table. Roosevelt said,
I heard that fellow had a knife.
I nodded. He did.
And you took him down anyway, unarmed.
Bane said, yes, he did, and in quick fashion. I don't think he even broke a sweat. Roosevelt replied,
Bully, my boy, bully! And that strapping lad?
He pointed at Frankie. This, Bane said, is my new friend, Franklin Amadeus Jackson. And even if he is blacker than my burnt toast this morning, he is one of the few real men I've ever known. I was really trying not to choke at this point. Green growled,
Right, now, can we play some goddamn poker?
Whole Lotta Shakin' is a short story by Robert Lee Beers, author of the Tony Mandolin Mysteries, the best unknown supernatural mystery series on the planet. The Tony Mandolin Mysteries take place in and around today's San Francisco, and in style are a mashup of Nero Wolfe, Harry Dresden, and the Vimes novels of the immortal Sir Terry Pratchett. There are 7 finished novels in the series, an 8th in the works, and several short stories offered for free on Kindle Unlimited. If you go to asmbeers.wixsite.com/robertleebeers, everything is there and more. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show. If you like the story, I post new ones every Monday and Friday. Or, of course, you could sign up for my weekly mailing list at talltaletv.com, and I'll send them straight to your inbox. I'm Chris Herron, and that's it for today's Tall Tale TV.